As most of you know, he has done very important work with Pegasus of variation, the field of sciences, and professor transition in the other field as well. He was a former director of the Center of Nonlinear Analysis in Continental University, and he is an editor of many dozens of journals. And I'm glad he accepted our invitation to give a course here. He will talk about topics in incubator stability and the phase changes. There are some changes of the schedule. We're going to post it later. All right.
Thank you very much, Shang Feng. It's certainly a wonderful pleasure to be here and a wonderful opportunity to talk to you about these issues, which I think are very pregnant for us. And I'll have a number of things to say about that, a number of small mini-sermons about why I think we should study these issues. And I must say that I was asked to give a course like Henri, and it is a little embarrassing to be before such a large group of experts, but I want those of you who are don't feel you're experts to know that this is really directed at you. And so let's get going a little bit. So this is an outline of the topics of the first topic I would like to cover. There are three topics I would like to cover. And the first one is about stable and metastable systems and simple coarse graining methods for simple multiple scale systems. And I'd like to illustrate this with a very classical question, just the Stoner-Wolfarth magnet. That has two advantages. First, it brings to the forefront the issue of what metastable systems are. We all know what metastable systems are, but this is perhaps the simplest one. On the other hand, it's too generic, so our solution won't really, what we pursue after that won't really apply to magnetic systems. But the second reason for studying the Stoner-Wolfarth magnet is that we all want to know what magnets are, right? So we should do that too. And then this will involve mass transfer ideas and what we call the variational principle of the Fokker-Planck equation. So what would be a magnet? So here's a typical magnetic system, like the picture below is a picture of, this is a micrograph of terphenol. There it is. There you see a loading curve and an unloading curve. So in the bottom it loaded, in the top it unloaded. There it goes. That worked pretty well. And so all I did was do something to that system and then undo it. So if this system were sort of in equilibrium during that process, it wouldn't have had two states, one which was down here on the loading and up, and the second which was up there on unloading, you see. If there are two states, typically they can't both be minimum energy. So the system is not stable. It's only metastable somehow. And this is an example of such a system. Terphenol D is in, it's a known actuator material. It's an actuator material for magnetic systems. I didn't bring one with me, but if you ever stop by in Pittsburgh, I can show you some. The second topic I'd like to discuss is grain growth in polycrystals and our mesoscale interface mapping project. And one of the morals here is that we are entering, or we have entered, a new phase of experimental science in the last 10 years where it is possible to rapidly collect huge amounts of data about systems which we have, in which we have very intense interest. And this data has two properties. First is, this information has two properties. The first is that it's not at the finest scale of the system. It's at the scale of a system where you can observe it. And the second is that it has certain structure. And polycrystals are a terrific example of that. So here are just two pictures which come off our experimental procedure, our experimental apparatus. This is alumina. Alumina, when it's color, when it, this color is by the microscope in order for you to tell the difference. When it's colored by a mineral, then it's called sapphire. So it's normally transparent. So this is textured aluminum, and this is random. So which is better? Well, it depends on what you want to use it for. So textured aluminum will be, that textured microstructure will be good to have to achieve fracture toughness in a given direction, whereas a random distribution of grains here, these are orientations of the grains, would be good to, if you want, say, isothermal heat properties or something like that. And below is a simulation. And the final example I'd like to talk about is what we call diffusion-mediated transport, or, and in particular, I want to describe the Markov chain paradigm for what's called the Brownian ratchet. And this is also an example of a multiple-scale system, a nanoscale system. The main application here is, as you can imagine, protein motors. This is a picture of what is probably a protein motor, a kinesin motor, on an actin track inside a mouse nerve cell, a mouse axon. And what people, and there's a lot of activity here, mostly to understand what these things really do. But there are also groups that are trying to harness them. I'll show pictures similar to this many times because they'll all be a little different and they'll illustrate different things. But this is an example of protein motors in action. Of course, they're not protein motors, what you're looking at. It's the inverse problem. Those are the tracks sitting on a bed of motors, because the motors are only about 25 nanometers wide, so you can't possibly see them. But the tracks are maybe as long as you see here. This is 20 microns. So a given track might be 20 microns, and there's a bed of only 25 nanometer gadgets working on it. Now, I think that's all I want to do today. Whoops, yes. So, excuse me, so I just have then one, a couple parables. I like to collect parables and statements about metastable systems. The first is this Frank and Ernest cartoon. It says, "Crooked is such a harsh term. I prefer nonlinear." And here, all stable systems are alike. Every metastable system seeks equilibrium in its own way. So this is by a famous Russian author. And then, actually, I saw this on a bumper sticker, but it was pointed out to me. It comes from Tolkien, from the Lord of the Rings. Not all who wander are lost. So this is also something to say about metastable systems. So I think that's it for the computer today. Yes, this stuff now, the rest of today, we will do on the board because it's easier. And probably most of next time, too, and then we shall return to our movies and other presentations. So now if we could have the screen, let me see, how do I turn the screen up? Up. And should I turn that off? So let's talk briefly about a magnet to see if we can understand what the main issues are. Oops. It can't be stolen. Maybe just fold it down. There. Now we're fine. So a magnet is basically a body. So this is very elementary. This is so elementary, it's a good thing there's at least one person in the room who doesn't know what a magnet is, or it would be almost shameful. So here we're only going to talk about two-dimensional magnets, though they're not real magnets, but it's close enough, and it illustrates what the issue is. So we have some region occupied by the magnet. That's omega. So this is a region occupied by the magnet. And the magnet means that it's magnetizable. So there are little vectors in this magnet. What characterizes a two-dimensional magnetostatic configuration? There's a magnetic induction vector. Magnetic induction. There's the magnetization. There's the magnetic field. Field, and there's the magnetization. The magnetization has constrained length, which is a function of temperature. It's a vector. These are all two-dimensional vectors. And they're related by the field equations, which, of course, are Maxwell's equations. The divergence of B is zero. The curl of H is zero. So right away, we're going to write H equals minus the gradient of some function U. The relation between B and H is given by B equals H plus M times the characteristic function of the region omega, which that means, given the way we've written this, this is minus the gradient of U plus M times the characteristic function of omega. The magnetization only lives in the material. The other fields live everywhere. That's the big problem with magnets. That's why they work. So this isn't complete. So the divergence of B is zero. So that's the field equation. So you can see what the field equation is. I won't even bother writing it down. Well, maybe I will. So we have here the Laplacian of U is the divergence of M times the characteristic of function of omega. So this is in all of R2. This is the field equation. Now, this doesn't characterize the system, of course. This doesn't distinguish one magnet for another. There's an anisotropy energy. So if we suppose that M equals 1 and then let alpha be a unit vector, which we'll call M, then we'll write phi of alpha. This is an anisotropy energy. And there are different forms for this. It can be incredibly complicated. It can be incredibly complicated even when it reflects accurate crystal and isotropy, you know, actual variant structure. What's your question?
What is the theta? As M to absolute value equal to F theta, what is the theta mean? Temperature or something?
Temperature.
Oh.
If the temperature is too high, it's not a magnet anymore. Not magnetizable. So here are two simple examples. If phi of alpha is kappa alpha 2 squared, so this means that kappa positive. So think of kappa as being positive now. So this is called uniaxial. The material I showed you a picture of, terphenol, that is uniaxial. That is typically uniaxial, but it's only uniaxial in each of those little stripes that was in the picture. So normally we consider it to be cubic, or close to cubic, where the energy might be kappa times alpha 1 alpha 2 squared. So this is cubic. And here we call x1 axis easy, because The second direction, the two direction, is penalized because the energy, you know, it carries energy as we go in X2. So it wants to line up like this. It wants to line up like that. So now I'm going to see. I don't have color, so I'm going to. So now this H, letter H, I'm going to reintroduce. So now let H be an applied field. It was retired when I introduced the gradient of U. And now I can write down an energy. So now I'll write down an energy E of H and M. Well, but M is now just alpha because I've reduced the parameters. And this is just the integral over omega of phi of alpha minus H dot alpha dx. It's just that, plus the field energy, though there's field energy, right? Field energy will be plus, see, you normalize constants here, grad u squared. So that's the energy of magnetic system. And so we have this energy, and then there is a constraint that the Laplacian mu is the divergence of alpha times the characteristic function of omega. And now, to understand what this system does, we just want to minimize this as a function. We want to minimize this function, this energy, as a function of, for given H, we want to minimize this energy as a function of alpha. So that should be what it does. We now calculate the minimum over alpha of E of H and alpha. Everything there depends on alpha. Okay. So suppose H is just one-dimensional. H is just H1, 0. And phi is this uniaxial energy, so it would prefer to be always in the x1 axis. Then it's very easy to know what the minimum energy is. You can do this. But let me say how you can do it. Do it for a sphere. So let's do it for a ball. So we're going to suppose omega is a ball. If we suppose omega is a ball, am I going too slowly here? Should I go more? Do I speed up? If omega is a ball, despite the modernity of what I claim to be telling you in the next few lectures, this is... What? Oh, a light on the blackboard. Yes, that'd be a good idea. That would be a good idea. Maybe it's over here?
No. That's favorable.
Maybe here. No, that's the screen. Well, no, you have to get this one on.
Just this two, like that.
Well, there's one up there, too. That just is... No, it's not.
It's just for the screen.
The side of the table?
For the right hand side, the bottom? It's a brief. Okay. Very good. All right. So, despite, as I said, the modern nature of the subject which we're discussing, and in fact, the Stoner-Wolfarth magnet, which is what we're talking about here, was in fact originally, although it was introduced as a general description of these things in the late 40s, finds some of its most important applications in magnetic memory devices. So it's a very modern thing. Despite that, if we suppose omega to be a ball, then we are reduced to in order to study this magnetic energy, which is called the demagnetization field or demag field or just the field energy. This is the case of the homogeneously polarized ellipsoid. Which is of course due to Dirichlet. So this simplifies our technical issues, and we can go back to try to understand what the main issues are. So in other words, we want to solve the equation Laplacian U is the divergence of C times the characteristic function of omega, where omega is a ball. You may know this. So you know how to do this?
Yes.
You know how to do this. Right. So we know how to do this. So we do this. So this is just d(c), pardon? Of the character. You were at my last lecture 30 years ago, right? So this is just d(c) of the characteristic function of omega. So first you solve Laplacian W equals the characteristic function of omega, and then U is dW dc. And what you don't know is that used to be called the method of images. That's what you don't know. Okay. So that's the method of images. And it was before people knew that you could actually do that. And if you do that, and then calculate the energy, then you find out that E of H and alpha, I'll just write the whole thing down, is equal to pi times phi of alpha minus H dot alpha. It's going to be obtained, obviously, for a constant value. Well, alpha, you don't have a choice. Alpha, the length of alpha has to be 1. So you can take alpha to be either 1, or it's a unit vector. Alpha is a unit vector. It has to be a constant unit because it's homogeneously polarized, see? And then plus pi over 4. There, that's the answer. So it doesn't matter what unit vector it is, it's always the same answer. That's the result of being a homogeneously polarized ellipsoid. So you can see then exactly what the answer is. If we start with H large and positive, then the, and this is alpha 1, and then the minimum is attained exactly in this way. You come down here to 0, then you go down, and then you go across like that. So that's the minimum energy. That's the minimum energy if you assume a homogeneously polarized ellipsoid. If you assume constant magnetization in the body. Now, you could assume something less than that. You could assume that at each point, it's a different constant. In other words, you could assume that alpha equals alpha of x. In that case, there are two special points here, minus 2 kappa, I think, and 2 kappa. That's plus 2 kappa, and here's minus 2 kappa. And then the minimum energy looks like that. Then the minimum energy looks like that. So in each case, the picture you would see, one picture would go like this. If the particle is so small so that it physically does not make sense for it to make domains, and therefore it will have constant magnetization, or if it can make itself a lot of domains, and we worked this out a long time ago, it would kind of go down like this, and then across and back like that. Neither of those are the picture you saw in the movie. The picture you saw in the movie is something different. The picture you saw in the movie goes like this, actually. It goes down here to a point, which is minus 2 kappa, and then fell down and went across. It actually went the other way. And then, going back, it went up here, and then up and across. So, therefore, understanding the minimum energy of a magnet does not help you to predict its behavior under magnetic loading. Okay? The system is not stable. It is only metastable, somehow. What it means, what does it mean for it to be metastable? Well, we just saw two explanations of that. Yes, one is that every system is metastable in its own way, and the other is not all who wander are lost. So we have to find out what that means. Okay. Now, we know how to do that, though. We know how to do that. Stoner, Wolfarth knew how to do that. So we know how to do that. It's very easy. Let me just tell you the answer. Because it's so easy, you can work it out for yourself. And that's why these numbers, 2 kappa and minus 2 kappa, are very important to as guides.
May I ask a question? Just before you raise that, because I missed, could you tell us one more second about the anisotropy, one more time, how it enters in the...
Its origins or what it is?
A little bit more about the physics, because I didn't...
No, you didn't, right. Right.
And if the anisotropy is determined a priori, or if it is sort of part of the problem. And
the anisotropy energy is a constitutive. In the theory, the anisotropy energy is a constitutive assumption. It's a statement. It's a statement about the crystalline. It's a statement about the nature of the particular material. And different magnets have different anisotropy energies.
And I didn't see quite clearly how that relates to the equations, the field equations. So phi.
Phi is the anisotropy energy. So this...
What is the definition of your alpha?
What is the what?
Alpha.
Alpha is, well, I said M, the magnetization. I'm assuming that I've normalized this so that the absolute value of the magnetization, which is constant, is 1. So I'm just going to take it to be some unit vector, alpha. Alpha is a unit vector. Alpha is M. Does that help? So the anisotropy energy is given. In this particular example, we're taking the anisotropy energy to be some constant kappa times alpha 2 squared. Sine squared theta, where theta is the angle of magnitude. That's what uniaxial means. One direction is preferred. In this case, it's the x1 direction. Because if it's a kappa is positive. So if you have any other alpha, you're adding energy. So to make energy smaller, you have to make that 0.
Alpha is orientation for M, or is it just M itself?
Right, it's M itself because I scaled away the temperature dependence.
So alpha is a vector.
So we know how to answer the problem of why the curve looks like this. Okay, we know how to answer that. You know how to answer that. You just work it out. You just now write this function E of H and alpha. So it really now depends only on two. These are really two scalars. Alpha is equal to alpha 1 0, or it's equal to cosine theta sine theta. And which, in other words, a function of theta. And H only has one component, H1. And so if you look at the total value, if you look at the energy as a function, here is H. So and it has this property that And we have a family of functions which depend on H. And a family of functions depend on H, and they have a minimum at alpha equals the vector 1, 0. That's what happens. And so if we introduce a new parameter, say lambda equals 2 kappa plus H1, and here I'm talking about this loading, the curve going in this direction, then we have, as long as lambda is bigger than 0, we have a minimum, say, we just have a function here. We just have a function which has some minimum way out there, and then it has a local minimum here. It has a local minimum here as long as lambda is positive. So if lambda is positive, our function has a local minimum. In other words, it has a local minimum for H1 bigger than minus 2 kappa at alpha equals 1, 0. But when H1 equals minus 2 kappa, that local minimum becomes unstable, and so it falls. Alpha, unstable, local min. Namely, becomes an inflection point. So this is explicitly a problem in first-year calculus. It's just an inflection point. So this becomes unstable, and it falls. And that's the solution. And that's the solution that was offered by Stoner and Wolfarth. And that's accurate. It works. That's right. That's why. That's why this situation is metastable. But what it isn't, why I'm before you today, what it isn't is, say, tell us, is why you can reduce the problem to why you can sort of wish away all these other parameters in the problem and make this into a question about a functions of a single variable. It doesn't tell us that at all. So I've essentially canceled out any possible complexity in this problem and written it down as a first-year calculus problem. But what I'm alleging is that this is what happens in the laboratory. So why does a first-year calculus problem have something to do with what happens in the laboratory? There are infinitely many degrees of freedom about that. Well, we know how to answer that question, too. We know how to answer that question, too. And so let me remind you about... Well, I'm going to need more chalk. Let me remind you why that is the case. So once again, this is the energy. Thank you. And so the main question now is why does 1D picture work? So this is the question I want to ask. I'm asking, and I'm saying we know the answer. You know the answer too, probably. And the answer is this. So we have this domain, omega, which I'm going to draw over again now. And I'm now going to assume that omega consists of many small, non-interacting magnetic particles. Many small, non-interacting magnetic particles, statistically homogeneous. That means they all have the same properties, statistically have the same properties, and there is a density for their magnetization, rho of x and lambda. Lambda is that parameter. Density, and x is just equal to the angle of the magnetization here. It's what replaces alpha. And now we just have an energy, C sub lambda of x, which is E of H and alpha. So remember, H is minus is 2, the lambda is 2 kappa plus h1, h2 is 0, that's h alpha is the angle of alpha is x. And now we can minimize that function. The integral of c lambda rho, plus, well, that has to be, that's the statement here, that there are small, many small non-interacting magnetic particles which are statistically homogeneous, means I have to introduce some entropy. Sigma rho log rho dx. This is a minimum. Well, we know how to solve that. It's an equation ddx of sigma d rho dx plus c lambda prime, that's the derivative of a function of x, times rho equals 0, or you might just pass immediately to the solution rho of x and lambda is 1 over some normalization constant so that it has unit mass times e to the minus 1 over sigma c lambda. So there. That is, that's the answer. And in this situation, C of x and lambda is a function which has a minimum at x equals 0 for each lambda, and it's stable for stable for lambda positive and becomes unstable when lambda is negative, when lambda is 0. And so we can write out C for lowest order terms. So we can write C of X and lambda as some constant C0. It has no first order term because because X equals 0 is a critical point for every lambda. And then so it has here something like lambda over 4 X squared and then other stuff. And then rho of x and lambda is exactly the square root of lambda over 4 pi. It begins to look familiar, e to the minus lambda over 4 x squared, maybe plus is about that. And and now, in order to understand what happens in this system, what I have to calculate is why this becomes unstable. I have to calculate the variance of this distribution. So I now have to calculate x squared rho of x and lambda dx. And this is equal to a constant divided by a lambda. Lambda is positive. And so, as lambda tends to 0, it diverges. And so, as lambda tends to 0, there is an increasing frequency of very large wavelength disturbances. And so it becomes easier and easier for this system to become unstable. And finally, when lambda is equal to 0, it becomes unstable and falls somewhere and does something else. And that's the answer. This is actually the same reasoning in standard textbooks for called critical opalescence. And you know exactly what this is. Lambda is 1 over T. And time, and this is a solution of the heat equation, and essentially telling you that the second moment of the solution to the heat equation becomes infinite as time tends to infinity, which you know. And that's the reason. So in other words, a simple statistical argument tells us that long wavelength fluctuations destabilize the system at the inflection point. Okay, long wavelength fluctuations destabilize the system at this inflection point. And we were able to deduce that because we considered this as a statistical system instead of as a one-dimensional continuum system. And the with the, considering it as a statistical system, gives rise to the one-dimensional system. Okay. And so this is classical. But it doesn't tell us what happens next. See? It simply tells us that something happens. So, I want to revisit what we did. I don't know how far off I am here. I probably have, 5 minutes or 10 minutes we started.
We always start late.
Yeah.
Maybe today we can... Ten more minutes?
Ten minutes, yeah. That should be... Hang on, guys. I want to look at this system again at the statistical level, but choose even a more... even a simpler statistical analogy, even a simpler one than this one. I'm missing page 4 in my notes. Here they are. So let's suppose we have an arbitrary potential, and we have sigma as some parameter, and I want to sample this configuration with the idea of minimizing it. So by sampling this configuration, I mean you can think of a plot of the function as being put on here. So these are the statistical things. And I'm going to just mark off a number of points here, okay? And each of these points, each of these equidistant points corresponds to a bin. And I'm just going to sample this configuration, x1, x2, and so forth up to xm. And I have many trials, xi, and I put these xi into bins here, and when I do, I'll obtain some kind of histogram. These are just the number of trials that fit into each of these points. So xi is each trial x is equal to some xi, and they have energies. Those trials have energies, and I can write down those energies. Energies depend on the potential and how they're distributed according to those trials. So the first thing is that when these trials are indistinguishable. So when I throw down these trials and I do these trials, all I can see are the occupation numbers. All I can see are the occupation numbers. In other words, how many of the big X's are in box 3, how many of the big X's are in box 8, and so on. All I can see are the occupation numbers. And that means that if I want to write an energy, which depends on occupation number n, n1 up to nm, which I shall scale and write as n over the length of n, which you know means the sum of the ni's, then this is the sum of C of xi times ni over the length of n, and then minus sigma divided by the length of n, because I'm scaling that, times the logarithm of n over n. That's the combinatorial factor. And that has to be there because all I can see are the occupation numbers. So that's the origin of that term. In other words, that's the origin, as you know. That's Boltzmann's argument, right? And now... So now I have this histogram. That's called sometimes an a priori distribution, right? It's called an a priori distribution or an a priori statistic or something like that. These are some statistics. And now what I want to know is what the most likely statistic is. What's the most likely statistic? So as n and the number of boxes here, here I'm going up to xm, tend to infinity, most likely distribution satisfies the integral over omega of C rho plus sigma rho log rho dx equals minimum. In other words, it minimizes the energy. And so in continuum theory, we are always thinking that minimum energy means that a system's at minimum energy. But when we are thinking statistically, we are always thinking that minimum energy is really the most likely energy. This is just the most likely energy. So this is the most likely energy, and there it is. And this is how it arises in this way. So now if we want to know what happens next, we can consider two histograms. And we can try to, because at one state we'll have one histogram and in another state we'll have another histogram. So, same number of cells. And here we have another histogram. So this is nicer to do on PowerPoint and stuff, but it's too hard to write all these formulas. So now we're going to move this histogram, one histogram, to the other histogram. Before we had trials, each x was equal to some xi and an energy associated to that. Now we're going to attribute a cost to it. Now we're going to attribute a cost to it, and to do that, we're going to assume that our system has some fine-scale law, which we don't know too precisely, but we assume that our system has some fine-scale law that looks like a driving force. So this, in particular, is not any good. It's almost okay, but not really quite right for the magnet example. The magnet example is too generic. Too many different things are happening in magnets. You have to pick a particular situation for a particular type of application if you want to have a useful result about dynamics of a magnet. They're different. But this is more, so that's too generic. So now we're just thinking about moving histograms. It's almost an abstract problem, and we can consider this one. So if we write this as what we perceive the microscopic law to be, then we can write that as given xk minus 1, find xk by x minus xk minus 1 over time interval tau equals minus c prime of x, or, namely, that's just an implicit, an Euler state thing for this, or 1 over 2 tau x minus xk minus 1 squared plus c of x is minimized. And this tells us what our cost function should be. So we now have two ensembles, an xk minus 1 ensemble consisting of elements xk minus 1 little xi, and an xk ensemble consisting of elements xk j, say. And now we'll have a cost, 1 over 2 tau, xki minus xkj, xk minus xk minus 1 I squared plus c of xkj. This is always j. So this is going to, this is then a cost, a total cost, which looks like this. That's the simplest cost you can think of. The absolute simplest cost you can think of. And if we add these up, we can then have an energy which relates the pair of these histograms. F of n over the length of n, and n star over the length of n. The length of n's are the same here, which is just 1 over 2 tau times the sum of xi minus xj squared. So here n and n star are two collections of occupation numbers. The n star numbers are the predecessors, and the n's are the successors. Nij over the length of n plus the energy of before of n over the length of n. Now, Nij is just the number of Xi's, as in the number of Xi's that went to Xj. In other words, the number of the guys that were in this Xi box that ended up under the new histogram in the Xj box. So we're moving histograms with a cost. This is a Monge transfer problem. This is a Monge mass transfer problem. And if we now pass to the limit is now more complicated. So I'll erase these. You're not listening with all your ears at this moment anyway. Well, let me erase this and tell you. So limit is more complicated, and what is it? It's something which we call 1 over 2 tau d of rho, rho star squared, plus then the integral we had before. C rho plus sigma rho log rho. This goes to a minimum where rho star is given. And rho and rho star are two probability measures. And what is this? This is equal to the infimum of the integral of x minus y squared dp of x and y, where this is a joint distribution. For rho and rho star. And this particular Monge transfer metric is called the Wasserstein metric. Although you could have others. You could certainly have others. This particular one is called a Wasserstein metric. Your colleague. Now, I'm almost done. What I want to say, I want to make three remarks. The first is that it is a metric, and it metrizes the probability densities and the probability measures in the weak topology. Second is the moving histograms, moving one histogram to another. This suggests that coarse graining the system from its statistical level to a higher scale, which is a meso level, induces a topology with it. In other words, by going through this process, you're not imposing anymore. You're not free to impose your choice of how you want to find a solution. The topology of the system is now induced, and it's the weak star topology. So, the coarse graining determines the topology. Now, the surprise, maybe it's not a surprise, but the surprise is that this leads to an Euler equation, and the Euler equation is very familiar. And we'll talk about that next time. So that's the main point, that you can. So we can start with a very simple problem, okay? We can start with a very simple problem, and from that simple problem, by studying that simple problem, we can explore the metastability of that problem, and that can get, we can find out what it is. It's possible to find out what it is. Okay. That was only 10 minutes.